This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we talk about always is the central political question, war. This time, war in the Middle East.
We're given a timeline of the developments in the Middle East by the most prominent historian on the subject, Rashid Khalidi.
And next on Law and Disorder, we speak with a legal expert on what international law can be used to do against what Israel is doing and what's going on here in the United States.
We're fortunate to have Marjorie Cohen, an expert on international law, to discuss both of these very important issues.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm Jim Lafferty, a decades-long political activist and once the national director of the National Lawyers Guild.
I'm Stephen Rohde, retired civil rights lawyer and author on issues of civil liberties.
The humanitarian catastrophe Israel has engineered in Gaza has no precedent in the modern era. Patrick Lawrence recently wrote in that Israel hates the United Nations and all it stands for, international law above all, without limit. Last week, using American airplanes and bombs, Israel illegally attacked Lebanon and then Syria. It is aiming to get the United States involved in a war against Iran. Israel's action in overwhelming, displacing, and murdering the native Palestinians was baked into the Zionist plan from the start and carried out over the last 100 years. David Ben-Gurion, called the father of modern Israel, said that, quote, the Jewish people have a map which our youth and adults should try to fulfill from the Nile to the Euphrates. One needs an opportune moment for making it happen, such as a war, end quote. The events of October 7 of last year were merely the pretext. Ariel Sharon, Israeli general, prime minister, and statesman, was responsible for murdering Arabs in neighboring Lebanon. 17,000 civilians were killed in 1982. During the Israeli invasion of Lebanon, about 2,000 were killed in Sabra and Shatila, a massacre by phalangist allies of Israel and Sharon. Sharon said, quote, I don't mind it after the job is done. You put me in front of a Nuremberg trial and then jail me for life. Hang me, if you like, as a war criminal. What you don't understand is the dirty work of Zionism is not yet finished. Far from it. End quote. We will now see more of that dirty work carried out by the Trump administration, who has promised to finish the job. End quote. Today we speak with Rashid Khalidi, Professor Emeritus of Modern Arab Studies and the former holder of the Edward Said Chair at Columbia University. He recently wrote the book, The 100-Year War Against Palestine. Rashid Khalidi, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
It's a pleasure to be back.
Rashid, Israel is a colonial settler state, a project that was a cousin of white European colonialism. White settler states were set up by the European powers in Australia, New Zealand, Canada, America, Asia, and Africa. Israel was a different sort of project, wasn't it? Please talk about the similarities and the differences.
This is actually really a good question, because some of the most really shabby and shoddy responses to description of Israel as a settler colonial project are nitpicking criticisms of aspects that I think are worth discussing, but which don't change in any way the fact that Zionism from the beginning was a European settler project backed by an imperial power to replace an indigenous population with European immigrants. I mean, that's the definition of the European settler colonial projects you just mentioned, whether, you know, in North America or Australasia or parts of Africa. It was, however, it had differences from these classical projects. Probably the most important was every other settler colonial project was an extension of the sovereignty and the population of the mother country. In other words, England sent English settlers to Ireland to, you know, establish their sovereignty, the king's sovereignty over Ireland. Or the French Republic sent French settlers to Algeria to establish its sovereignty. That wasn't the case with Zionism. Zionism was from the beginning a national movement. It developed independently. Of course, it relied on an imperial power. I mean, Herzl was searching for, you know, he went to the Kaiser, he went to the Russian Tsar, he went to the Ottoman Sultan. He was searching for an external patron, but he had his own movement. And that distinguishes the Zionist project from other settler colonial projects, some of which develop into national projects. The United States is a settler colonial project that developed into a national project. Zionism starts off as both a settler colonial project and a national project, and it's not an extension of the sovereignty or the population of the mother country. In fact, it doesn't have a mother country. Another difference is that there is a religious connection in terms of Judaism and Palestine. Many settler colonial projects claimed to have some kind of religious sanction for what they were doing. You could describe a variety of them. I think the Boers in South Africa saw themselves as somehow, you know, fated by God to do what they did. City on a hill, the idea of the American colonies as some kind of God-protected project. So it's not unique in that respect, but it makes it different in some ways, because there is a genuine connection between Judaism as a religion and the Holy Land. And the final difference, and this is often cited, is, well, you know, this is a refuge for persecution. Now, you know, you can walk and chew gum at the same time. You can be a refuge for persecution and a eliminationist settler colonial project destroying the natives. Many of the settlers who come to North America, whether they're Quakers or whether they're Puritans or whether they're Huguenots, are fleeing religious persecution in Europe. That doesn't make them any less exterminationist in the way in which they deal with the indigenous population, with Native Americans. So, I mean, it's very clear from its practice, from its behavior, from the way in which it's similar to other settler colonial projects that Zionism is one. But at the same time, it has all of these distinctive characteristics, some of which are actually unique.
Rashid, following up on the last question, once Israel itself was established, of course, it wanted and it needed to secure a military, diplomatic, economic support of the USA. And U.S. happily has given it billions and billions of dollars over the years. On the other hand, Israel was planted there in the middle of Arab countries, Arab oil, if you will. What was it that the American policymakers reasoned that this was a good bargain for them to have Israel there, despite how the Arab nations might feel about it?
Well, one of the things that was figured out very early on by the Pentagon, at a time when some people in the American diplomatic corps at the State Department were saying that support for Israel, we're talking about in the 1940s, we're talking about support for Israel or for the establishment of Israel as being harmful to American relations with the Arab countries, was the Pentagon's discovery that this was an extraordinarily efficient military machine. Very early on in the 1948 war, they saw that Israel had capabilities vis-a-vis the countries around it, which they saw could be useful. Irene Genzier shows this in one of her books. And so that's the first thing. Israel as an instrument or a tool or a weapon that the United States saw that it could employ in the region. And it does that, for example, in 1967. An Israeli official comes to Washington. He meets the president, President Johnson. He meets McNamara, the Secretary of Defense, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. And all of them say, you know, go for it. And what are they saying? What are they saying this for? Because Israel is about to attack what are seen in Washington as Soviet proxies. So this military machine that people in the Pentagon saw as having this wonderful potential back in 1948 is actually used in 67 to smash Soviet armed Arab countries during the 67 war. So that's one thing. The second thing that they realized in Washington is, given regimes like the Saudi regime, which talk a good game about Palestine but don't do anything about it, you could have your cake and eat it too. You could support Israel at the expense of Palestinians and Arabs and so on, but you could keep your privileged relationship with the biggest Arab oil exporter, which is Saudi Arabia. And this was realized very early on. There's a letter from, I think, General Marshall, who at this stage is the Secretary of State, to the Saudis, well into the 1948 war, thanking them for being so helpful and basically not making any trouble for the United States as it's supporting Israel during the first Arab-Israeli war. So I think that those are elements. There's also a domestic element. I mean, until recently, there was absolutely no pushback politically in the United States from being as extremely pro-Israel as any politician wanted to. And there was a lot of benefit for a politician in public opinion, in the media, in terms of political donations, and in terms of votes in supporting Israel, and absolutely no downside. There were no votes that would go against you because of supporting Israel. There were no donors who would cut you off. There was no media that would castigate you. Now, that's changed. In the 2020s, that's changed. It could be argued that Harris may have lost Michigan because of it. Didn't lose the election because of it, may have lost Michigan because young people voted against her or didn't vote or voted for Trump or voted for Jill Stein, Arab Americans, Muslim Americans. That's the 21st century. But up until very recently, there was just no downside politically, and there was a big upside to it. So I think these are all factors in why policymakers thought it would be advantageous to them to support Israel.
Rashid, I believe that in the process, Israel has become the creature of the United States, not vice versa. The Israeli tail is not wagging the American dog. Do you agree?
You know, on the issue of Palestine, and only on the issue of Palestine, because there has been absolutely no pushback in the United States, as I just said, I think the United States gave Israel free rein. I wouldn't say the tail was wagging the dog, but the dog put up no resistance to whatever wagging the tail wanted to do. And that has been the case consistently where Palestine is concerned. Where broader Middle East policy is concerned, it's absolutely not the case. The United States has enforced on Israel its will whenever American policymakers determined that American national interests would be gravely affected by Israeli action. So when Israel invades the Sinai together with Britain and France, Eisenhower kicks them out unceremoniously. Pays absolutely no attention to their protestations. He does exactly as he pleases. And there are multiple examples of similar American behavior where vital American strategic or other interests are seen to be at issue. So after the 1967 war, after the War of Attrition, after the 67 war of Attrition, 73 war, Sadat wants to, you know, move over to the American column from the Soviet column. He wants to make peace with Israel. The Israelis aren't interested. The Americans forced them into three different disengagement agreements, two with Egypt and one with Syria. And later on, the United States brokers the Camp David Accords and peace treaty. Egypt was much more valuable to the United States, and winning the Cold War was much more important to the United States than, you know, putting up with Israeli insistence that Sinai without peace is better than peace without Sinai. That was the Israeli position until Kissinger and President Nixon and President Ford forced them to give up, to begin the process of giving up the Sinai Peninsula. I would argue that President Reagan stopped the war cold on the 12th of August, 1982, when Israel was besieging and bombarding Beirut. President Obama imposed the JCPOA, the nuclear deal with Iran, in the teeth of ferocious Israeli opposition. Various American administrations have sold weapons to Arab oil-producing countries against the protestations of Israel. So where the dog wanted something important, it would not allow the tail to wag it. Where Palestine was concerned, Israel has had, up until recently, including this, the past couple of administrations, but really from the beginning, absolute free rein. The United States put almost no restraint on Israel, and indeed supported Israel, irrespective of whatever it did. I mean, during this past war, the Israelis have repeatedly flouted everything the American administration said to them and, in fact, slapped Biden in the face again and again and again. And there was absolutely no penalty for that.
Rashid, after the Second World War, the United States, other countries more than the United States, pushed for, and there was, of course, United Nations and international criminal courts and what have you. It's pretty clear, is it not, that Israel hates, though, the United Nations and everything it seems to stand for, especially under international law and with respect to the International Criminal Court. There's just been a development in that, has there not? Talk to us about the ways in which Israel and the United States have, in fact, sought to undermine the international legal apparatus that was set up after World War II precisely to prevent war and genocide.
Well, I think you have a joint interest here. As between the United States and Israel. In the case of Israel, it's particularly ironic since Israel is a stepchild of the United Nations. I mean, its birth certificate is the Partition Resolution of 29 November 1947, General Assembly Resolution 181. That's what gives the international mandate for a Jewish state in Palestine. And the fact that Israel has bitten the hand that fed it, created it, whatever you want to say, systematically ignoring the United Nations, killing United Nations personnel. They've killed hundreds of UN personnel in Gaza, people working for UNRWA and others, killed and maimed hundreds of people in Gaza. And, you know, that is of a piece with their absolute contempt for the United Nations. Ever since Ben-Gurion, he had a derogatory term for the UN in Hebrew. Back in the 50s, we're talking about. That has been the case consistently with Israel. The United States, when the UN bent to the will of the United States in the early years of the Cold War, the United States was much more careful about treating the United Nations in a hostile manner. That has changed over time. Since the non-aligned movement, since decolonization, since the arrival of large majorities in the General Assembly that do not vote with the United States, the United States has systematically, I think, undermined UN and international law, much of which it doesn't accept its application to the United States. So the United States acts as if international law applies to everybody else, but not to this country. So that's a sense in which these two countries, Israel and the United States, sort of see things the same way.
You're listening to Law and Disorder Radio. I'm attorney Michael Smith, your host. I'm with your co-host, attorney Jim Lafferty, my former law partner, and we're speaking with Rashid Khalidi, the emeritus professor of Arab Studies at Columbia University. Rashid, prospectively, what lies in store for the people of Gaza and the West Bank, Lebanon, Syria, Yemen, and Iran?
Well, I mean, I'm a historian, Michael. I try and avoid answering questions like this because, as I say, the job description of a historian does not include predicting the future. I'm not going out on a limb, however, when I say that the prospects for the people of Gaza are extraordinarily bleak. Israel has systematically attacked the civilian population of Gaza, has systematically dismantled the civilian infrastructure of Gaza, has destroyed water purification plants, sewage plants, electricity networks, pretty much the entire infrastructure of human existence in the Gaza Strip. Since the day one of this war, since right after the Hamas attack of the 7th of October. And so the future is going to be extraordinarily bleak. It looks like they are going to live under an extremely harsh Israeli military occupation of one sort or another, direct or indirect. It looks like Israel will not stop its attacks on the Gaza Strip, even if there's a so-called ceasefire. It looks as if the process of the Gazans deciding on who will rule them is not going to be one that Israel or the United States is going to allow. It looks as if reconstruction is going to be extraordinarily difficult and lengthy. It looks as if malnutrition will affect the growth of children for several years to come. It looks as if the trauma and the post-traumatic stress syndrome that has been inflicted on the entire population of the Gaza Strip will haunt them for years to come. I mean, you don't need a crystal ball to predict those things. As far as the West Bank is concerned, they have a different kind of hell, which is the no longer creeping annexation and the no longer hidden objectives of Israeli governments to absorb the West Bank into Israel without giving the people of the West Bank any rights. So they will be helots, they will be, restricted to Bantustan, smaller and smaller areas. And Israel will take over more and more land, more and more land, will implant more and more settlers, will be more and more oppressive. That seems to be the course that the Israeli government is taking, at least right now. And I don't see much in the way of opposition to it within Israel or from the outside, since the United States will arm it and protect it and shield it and veto Security Council resolutions that would purport to do anything about stopping that process. So the whole world is against what Israel is doing in the West Bank. And the whole world would have absolutely no effect, and Israel will have complete impunity given the blank check that the United States writes for it. Lebanon is being devastated as we speak. A second a first line of border villages, dozens of border villages, have already been flattened. The Israeli military is busy flattening a second line of border villages, as well as attacking targets all over Lebanon. The effect of that has been to displace well over a million, perhaps as much as 1.5 million Lebanese, and to create all kinds of social and political and sectarian tensions in Lebanon in consequence, intentionally creating those tensions. Israel is adept at playing, you know, that divide and rule game of setting one group against another. They've been doing it for generations now, starting in Palestine, and they've been doing it in Lebanon for a very long time as well. So I think that it depends on whether a ceasefire is achieved, and it depends on whether Israel respects that ceasefire. It's very unlikely to do so, even if one is imposed. So Lebanon faces a very uncertain future. As far as the other countries are concerned, a lot depends on whether we can ever see a ceasefire in Lebanon and Gaza. And the United States just having vetoed a ceasefire resolution regarding Gaza yesterday, I see no end to this current misery, this current horror in the near future. I hope I'm wrong.
I wanted to ask the possibility of a war with Iran.
Okay, let me speak to that. I think there are two major actors that really would like to avoid a major war with Iran right now. They're Iran and the United States. I don't know if that'll continue to be the case under the Trump administration. Only God knows what Trump will do about anything, if God himself or herself knows. And so that's unpredictable. But it is perfectly clear that every sane strategist in the United States is not interested in seeing an expansion of this conflict to Iran. And it's perfectly clear that the Iranian regime has no interest in expanding the war. Their actions have been very carefully calibrated, as up to a point have been the actions of Israel, though Israel has been extraordinarily provocative at different times, pushing the Iranians as if it would like them to respond in a way which would justify an all-out war, attacking the Iranian embassy in Damascus, an unprovoked attack, attacking and killing a lot of Iranian officials in the Iranian embassy in Damascus, attacking the guest house of the Revolutionary Guards in Tehran and killing the leader of Hamas, with whom Israel was supposedly negotiating a ceasefire, attacking and killing several of the top leaders of Hezbollah, including Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah. These are extraordinarily provocative actions on Israel's part. And I think that indicates that there is certainly an element in the Israeli leadership, I would argue Netanyahu himself and many others, who would love to see Iran provoked into a serious escalation. And the objective of that would not just be to get Israel into a war with Iran or Iran into a war with Israel, but to drag the United States into fighting Israel's war for it. I think that has always been one of Netanyahu's objectives. Certainly since he came back into power at the beginning of the 21st century, and you know, he's Israel's longest serving prime minister. And in his recent incarnations as prime minister, the last couple of governments he's headed, it seemed very clear that was his objective, to get a war going with Iran that the United States would basically fight for Israel. I don't know if the Trump administration will fall into that trap. Trump has an isolationist tendency, which would mitigate against wars in the Middle East. He says he wants to end wars in the Middle East. At the same time, he's surrounded by some of the most fervent war-making hawk fanatics on the American scene. People who are viscerally anti-Iranian, people who believe that force is the only language that Iran understands, and who I think would like to go to war with Iran. So I'm not making a prediction about the future, but it's very clear that up to this point, neither the United States nor Iran wanted a major war, and that's one of the reasons we haven't had one so far between Iran and Israel, or with the United States and Iran.
Well, then, Rashid, summing up, we do have happily a few minutes left. What are some of your final thoughts as to where what you've been discussing, we've been discussing, it leaves us? Talk to us a bit about some summary thoughts you might have about where we're at the moment and what the future might look like.
I think one of the most important things about where we are at the moment is that there has been a sea change in American public opinion where Israel and Palestine are concerned. You never had more than one or two members of Congress who would speak up in any way that was critical of Israel. You had 19 senators who voted to cut off arms to Israel yesterday. I mean, if you look at the glass as half empty, you say it's only 19 senators. You couldn't have had one senator 10 years, 20, 30, 40 years ago. It would have been inconceivable. Things are changing, and they represent, those 19, overwhelming majorities of Democrats and majorities of Americans who are critical of the Biden administration policy on this war, who are against American arms sales to Israel, and who consider Netanyahu, if not a war criminal, a very bad person. This is new, and it's a result of young people basically detoxifying themselves as far as media are concerned. They don't listen to the lying mainstream corporate media. They get their news from alternative sources. And they know perfectly well what's going on in Gaza, which is hidden from us by the mainstream media, hidden from, you know, older people who only watch whatever, CNN, MSNBC, Fox, New York Times, Washington Post. This is a major change. This is not going to go away. You know, there have been changes in the past. At the time of the 1982 war, American public opinion was critical of Israel. At the time of the first Intifada in the late 80s, American public opinion was critical of Israel. But Israel's backers in this country, you know, fought back and pushed back and basically restored discipline. They are not going to be able to do it this time. Now, the other side of this is that power is on their side still. The elites are still completely supportive of Israel. The media is biased and one-sided, the mainstream corporate media, the politicians, the universities, the art galleries, the foundations. They're either completely supportive of Israel or they're terrified of being accused of anti-Semitism or whatever it may be. Any criticism of Israel now opens you up to the charge of anti-Semitism. Well, that's the last desperate resort of people who have nothing to say. There's no argument in favor of starving children in Gaza. There's no argument in favor of killing 45,000 Gazans. You can't get up and on your hind legs and say anything about those things. So you say you can't talk because you're an anti-Semite. That's the last resort. And that shows the fact that they are really desperate, but at the same time, they wield the levers of power. The politicians, by and large, are with them. The media, by and large, are with them. The elites in our society, by and large, are with them. So there's a struggle ahead between people who know, which is the majority, and people who, you know, don't want to know, and who are a minority, but still are the older folks who have most of the power. It took very, very long for the anti-war movement to stop the Vietnam War. It took a very long time for anti-apartheid movement to help overthrow apartheid. It took a very long time for the anti-war movement to stop the Iraq War. It'll take a long time for this public opinion, majority in public opinion, to force our lawmakers, our politicians, our media to change their tune. But I think we have a possibility that never existed before. There's an entirely new situation as a result.
Unfortunately, we've run out of our allotted time. I want to thank you on my behalf and Jim's behalf and on behalf of all of our listeners around the country. This has been an enlightening discussion. We're very grateful to have you on Law and Disorder.
It was a pleasure. Thank you.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
The re-election of Donald Trump will have disastrous effects inside the United States and around the world. Today we examine two related crises, one at home and the other in the Middle East. Israel's ongoing genocide in Gaza, according to Palestinian and international agencies, has killed at least 43,000 people, most of them women and children. At least 101,000 others have been wounded, and over 10,000 Gazans are missing and believed dead and buried beneath the rubble of hundreds of thousands of bombed homes and other structures. Millions more Palestinians have been forcibly displaced, starved, or sickened by Israel's invasion and complete siege of Gaza. In October, senior members of Israel Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's far-right cabinet and national lawmakers spoke at a conference advocating the ethnic cleansing and recolonization of Gaza. On October 28, the government of South Africa filed 750 pages of what it called, quote, overwhelming, unquote, proof that Israel is committing genocide in Gaza, and those documents were submitted to the International Court of Justice in The Hague, Netherlands. Under the court's rules, the contents of the memorial cannot be made public at this time, but in a statement, the office of South African President Cyril Ramaphosa called the material a, quote, comprehensive presentation of the overwhelming evidence of genocide in Gaza, unquote. In response to the genocide in Gaza, campus protests, which roiled over 400 colleges and universities last year, are heating up again. But this time, protesters face an incoming president who has promised to use the National Guard and even the U.S. military to brutally suppress dissent, whether in opposition to the renewed alliance between Trump and Benjamin Netanyahu, or in response to Trump's promise to launch mass deportations. Trump and his allies have reportedly drafted plans for him to deploy the military against civil demonstrators on his first day in office, according to a Washington Post report from November 2023. And Trump has also indicated that he will use the military to deport millions of undocumented immigrants. When Fox News asked Trump whether he thought, quote, outside agitators might have an effect on Election Day, Trump responded by saying, quote, I think the bigger problem is the enemy from within. He added, quote, we have some very bad people. We have some sick people, radical left lunatics, and I think they're the big. It should be very easily handled by, if necessary, the National Guard, or if really necessary, by the military, because they can't let that happen. We're very fortunate today to have a guest who is well-equipped to address both of these crises. Marjorie Cohn is professor of law emerita at Thomas Jefferson School of Law and former president of the National Lawyers Guild. Marjorie is also dean of the People's Academy of International Law and the U.S. representative to the Association of American Jurists. She writes frequently on U.S. and international law for Truth Out. Marjorie, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thanks so much, Steve.
Marjorie, first, just before we began recording this interview, there was very important news from the International Criminal Court. Please tell us about that, and then let's turn to the latest filing by South Africa in the International Court of Justice.
Well, first I want to make it clear to listeners the difference between the International Criminal Court and the International Court of Justice. The International Criminal Court is a criminal tribunal that brings charges against individual leaders and officials for genocide, war crimes, crimes against humanity, and the crime of aggression. The International Court of Justice is the judicial wing of the United Nations system. It's also known as the World Court or the ICJ. It's not a criminal tribunal, but it resolves disputes between countries. So the historic decision that you are referring to that happened on the 21st of November is that after 10 years of a preliminary examination and a formal investigation, the International Criminal Court, which is called the ICC, finally issued arrest warrants for Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and former Defense Minister Yoav Gallant, 6 months after Chief Prosecutor Karim Khan requested them. And also, the ICC issued an arrest warrant for a commander of Hamas as well, and I'll talk about that in just a minute. This is the first instance in the court's 22-year history that it has issued arrest warrants for Western allied senior officials. The court said that there are reasonable grounds to believe that Netanyahu and Gallant intentionally and knowingly deprived the civilian population in Gaza of objects indispensable to their survival, including food, water, and medicine and medical supplies, as well as fuel and electricity, from at least the 8th of October 2023 to the 20th of May 2024. This finding is based on the role of Netanyahu and Gallant in impeding humanitarian aid and violating international humanitarian law and failing to facilitate relief by all means at its disposal. And the court also talked about the cutting off of electricity and reducing the fuel supply as having a severe impact on the supply of water in Gaza and the capacity of hospitals to provide urgent care. And so Netanyahu and Gallant are charged with crimes against humanity, the crime against humanity of murder, and the crime against humanity of persecution. Mohammed Diab Ibrahim al-Masri, also known as Mohammed Deif, is a commander of Hamas's al-Qassam brigades, and he's charged with a crime against humanity and the war crime of murder over the mass killing of civilians on October 7, 2023, also charged with the crime against humanity of extermination and the crime of hostage taking, as well as outrages upon personal dignity. So this is really a historic development, Steve, and this means that the 124 countries that are parties to the Rome Statute of the International Criminal Court are now legally bound to turn these people over to the ICC in The Hague, Netherlands, if they are found in the territory of one of those 124 countries. And of course, Israel and the United States are not parties to the Rome Statute, but the Netherlands has come out and said if Netanyahu does set foot on Dutch soil, that he would be turned over to the Hague. So this is a really major development. And then moving into your second question about the International Court of Justice, the World Court, on January 26th, the ICJ ordered Israel to prevent all genocidal acts against Gazans, ensure that its military doesn't commit genocidal acts, and punish incitement to genocide and immediately enable basic services and humanitarian aid. And these so-called provisional measures by the ICJ, the World Court, were issued in response to a petition by South Africa. Then on March the 28th, the ICJ ordered Israel to ensure the unhindered provision of humanitarian aid to enter Gaza, including opening more land crossings and to ensure that its military doesn't commit genocidal acts, including obstructing urgently needed humanitarian assistance. And the ICJ quoted South Africa's rationale for its March 6th petition, which was prompted by the, and I'm quoting now, horrific deaths from starvation of Palestinian children, including babies, brought about by Israel's deliberate acts and omissions, including Israel's concerted attempts since 26 January to ensure the defunding of the United Nations Relief and Works Agency, or UNRWA, and Israel's attacks on starving Palestinians seeking to access what extremely limited humanitarian assistance Israel permits into northern Gaza in particular. The ICJ, on March the 28th, ordered provisional measures, including Israel is ordered to take all necessary and effective measures to ensure without delay the unhindered provision of urgently needed humanitarian assistance, food, water, electricity, fuel, shelter, clothing, hygiene and sanitation, medical supplies and medical care, and ensure that with immediate effect that its military does not commit genocidal acts. So that is what happened. Now, last month, and I think that you referred to this new filing by South Africa, that South Africa filed a, well, let me just back up, Steve, for a minute. And that is that provisional measures that I just described that were issued by the ICJ in January and March are just that, provisional measures that must be taken by Israel while the International Court of Justice is considering the merits of whether genocide is occurring. And they did find a plausible case that genocide was occurring, but this could take a few years to actually decide the case on the merits. So last month, South Africa filed a 750-page memorial that contained, quote, overwhelming proof that Israel is committing genocide in Gaza. And the document, according to South African President Ramaphosa, it contains evidence showing how the Israeli government has violated the Genocide Convention by promoting the destruction of Palestinians living in Gaza, physically killing them with destructive weapons, depriving them of humanitarian assistance, and causing conditions of life aimed at their physical destruction, and using starvation as a weapon of war. And he added that the evidence will show that undergirding Israel's genocidal acts is the special intent to commit genocide and a failure by Israel to prevent incitement to genocide, to prevent genocide itself, and failure to punish those inciting and committing acts of genocide.
Marjorie Cohn, has Israel responded or not responded to the interim rulings of the World Court? And what can the UN General Assembly do to enforce the World Court rulings?
Well, Israel has denounced the ICJ's preliminary rulings as anti-Semitic and refused to follow the orders of the World Court. The General Assembly can convene under the Uniting for Peace resolution and take action to order Israel to stop committing genocide. The problem is that Israel and its chief enabler and aider and abettor, the U.S. government, has been known to blackmail countries who are trying to get the General Assembly to meet under Uniting for Peace. So it's not clear that that will actually happen, but the General Assembly does have that power.
You're listening to Law and Disorder with today's guest, Marjorie Cohn. I'm Steve Rohde, and I'm joined by co-host Michael Smith. Marjorie, let's turn to the domestic front. Trump's prior term as president reveals that his threats to use the military go far beyond mere campaign rhetoric. Remind us of what he threatened to do last time.
Well, Trump has promised to carry out the largest deportation effort in U.S. history and said that he will declare a national emergency and use the military to deport millions of undocumented immigrants. During his campaign, he said that if he was reelected, he would use the military at the southern U.S. border and to enforce the law in cities like Chicago and New York, which he called crime dens. After massive demonstrations erupted around the country in protest against the May 25th, 2020 murder of George Floyd by the Minneapolis police, then-President Trump told his Secretary of Defense Mark Esper and Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff General Mark Milley that he wanted to invoke the Insurrection Act, which I will discuss in a minute. That allows the president to deploy the military domestically and use it for civilian enforcement. And Trump wanted to order 10,000 troops in Washington to get control of the streets. On June the 1st of 2020, Trump said, if a city or state refuses to take the actions that are necessary to defend the life and property of their residents, then I will deploy U.S. military and quickly solved the problem for them. Now, Esper and Milley objected. They said the turmoil was best handled by civil law enforcement and the D.C. National Guard. Trump was furious. He called his top military leaders losers, and he repeated his desire to send active duty troops into Minneapolis. He asked Milley, "Can't you just shoot them? Just shoot them in the legs or something." Trump also proposed sending federal troops into Chicago, Seattle, and Portland in response to Black Lives Matter protests. And once again, Esper and Milley, joined by then-Attorney General Bill Barr, talked him out of it. Trump has now expressed regret at not using U.S. troops in the aftermath of the summer 2020 Black Lives Matter protest. And he said at a rally in November of 2023, "The next time, I'm not waiting."
Marjorie, please describe for our listeners what the law is in this area, including the Posse Comitatus Act, passed in 1878, and the Separate Insurrection Act, and how Trump might try to invoke both of them to suppress dissent.
Well, Trump would actually invoke the Insurrection Act because the Posse Comitatus Act wouldn't help him. The Posse Comitatus Act was enacted in 1878 to end the use of federal troops in overseeing elections in the post-Civil War South. The Posse Comitatus Act bars the use of the military to enforce domestic laws, including immigration laws. The Posse Comitatus Act forbids the willful use of any part of the Army, the Navy, the Marine Corps, the Air Force, or the Space Force as a Posse Comitatus, or power of the county, or otherwise to execute the laws. The only exceptions to the Posse Comitatus Act's prohibition are when expressly authorized by the Constitution or an act of Congress. So the Insurrection Act carves out an exception to the Posse Comitatus Act. The Insurrection Act can be used to authorize the president to deploy the U.S. armed forces, federalize the National Guard, or deputize private militias of non-governmental forces within the United States. There are three sections of the Insurrection Act that the president could invoke, only one of which requires the consent of the state officials. First is Section 251 of the Insurrection Act, and that can be invoked where the legislature or governor of a state asks the president for assistance to quell an insurrection against the government. Secondly is Section 252 that the president can invoke where he decides that unlawful obstructions, combinations, or assemblages or rebellion against the authority of the United States render it impracticable to enforce U.S. or state law in the courts. And finally, Section 253 allows the president to invoke the Insurrection Act when any insurrection, domestic violence, unlawful combination, or conspiracy deprives people of a legal right, privilege, immunity, or protection that results in the denial of equal protection, or opposes or obstructs the execution of the laws of the United States or impedes the course of justice under those laws. So Section 252 can be triggered by the president's subjective belief that it is impracticable for the courts and criminal legal system to function properly, and courts would hesitate to overrule a president's subjective decision. Of course, we now have the recent decision of the supermajority, the right-wing supermajority of the Supreme Court, giving the president absolute immunity for any acts that are within his core constitutional functions. But the Insurrection Act does not authorize the president to deploy federal troops on U.S. soil to restore public order. And experts have said that the Insurrection Act should be construed narrowly. And there is, of course, the danger that the Trump administration, once he takes office, could send agents provocateurs into peaceful demonstrations to rile things up and make trouble, and then he could use that as an excuse to say, oh, I've got to send federal troops in. So it's a very, very frightening development, Michael.
Marjorie, the founders wanted civilian authorities to be a check on the military. Today, are the positions reversed? Will the Uniform Code of Military Justice, the Army Field Manual, or the Nuremberg Principles help protect us from Trump?
Well, the Uniform Code of Military Justice requires that all military personnel obey lawful orders. But a law that violates the Constitution or a federal statute is an unlawful order. Both the Army Field Manual and the Nuremberg Principles create a duty to disobey unlawful orders. So soldiers have not only a right but a duty to refuse illegal orders, yet the legality of those orders would be determined by courts-martial when they prosecute refusers. And service members have a moral obligation not to harm the innocent, but that harm would be inevitable if troops are used against civilians. And I just want to refer people to my book, which is called Rules of Disengagement, The Politics and Honor of Military Dissent, which I co-authored with Kathy Gilbert of the National Lawyers Guild Military Law Task Force, and it talks about prior refusers during the Vietnam War and during the Iraq War and what happened to them.
Marjorie, what are the defenders of the Constitution inside and outside Congress doing to try to block Trump, and what can our listeners do to support these efforts?
Well, in April, a bipartisan group at the invitation of the American Law Institute recommended reforms to the Insurrection Act because they said it gives presidents too much unchecked power. But they did not provide for courts to review decisions that the president makes under the Insurrection Act. There is, however, a bill pending in the Senate introduced by Richard Blumenthal in July that does contain a provision for judicial review. Given the current political climate, however, prospects for reform of the Insurrection Act are slim to none. But organizations like the ACLU are already preparing lawsuits to challenge Trump's promised use of the Insurrection Act to use U.S. troops in the United States against protesters and undocumented immigrants.
Marjorie, where can listeners find out more about your work?
I write a regular column for truthout.org, so if you go to truthout.org and go all the way down to the bottom of the page and click on Human Rights and Global Wrongs, that's the name of my regular column, and then my columns, videos, books, etc., interviews are collected on my own website, marjoriecohn.com.
Well, Marjorie, this has been a terrific interview. We're so fortunate to have somebody with your talents on our side. Thank you so much for being on Law and Disorder.
Thank you so much for having me, Michael and Steve.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org. One word, lawanddisorder.org.
A quick reminder. If you want to listen to Law & Disorder's podcast, one way to do that is visit lawanddisorder.org. There you'll see our podcast players now positioned at the bottom of each show's post. And there you can click on the three dots in the right corner of the player to either, well, download, subscribe, or visit the podcast page. Good, 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 good. That's great.
I was dreaming, in my dreaming, well, of an aspect bright and fair. And my sleeping, it was broken, but my dream, it lingered near. In the farm of shining valleys, where the pure air recognized. And my senses newly open, 'cause I awaken into the cry that the people have the power to redeem the world from fools. Upon the meek, the grace is shower. It's decreed the people rule. People have the power. People have the power. People have the power. People have the power. Vengeful aspects became suspect and bending low as if to hear. And the armies ceased advancing because the people had their ear. And the shepherds and the soldiers, where they laid beneath the stars, exchanging visions, laying arms to waste in the dust, in the form of shining valleys where the pure air recognized. And my senses newly opened, 'cause I awakened to the cry. Come on.
Hold on.
People have the power. People have the power. People have the power. People have the power. Where there were deserts, I saw fountains, and like cream, the waters rise. And we strolled there together, when none to laugh or criticize. And the leopard and the lamb lay together, truly bound. Well, I was hoping, in my hoping, to recall what I had found. I was dreaming, in my dreaming. God knows a pure view. As I surrender into my sleeping, I commit my dream to you. Come on. People have the power. People have the power. People have the power. People have the power. The power to dream, to rule, to wrestle the world from fools. It's decreed that people rule. It's decreed that people rule. Listen, I believe everything we dream can come to pass through our union. We can turn the world around. We can turn the Earth's revolution. We have the power. People have the power. The people have the power. Have the power. Thank you. Don't forget it. You have the power.